Speaker this morning is Mr. Steve Green, who is the president of Hobby Lobby. With over 700 stores, Hobby Lobby is the world's largest privately owned arts and crafts store. At some point, probably you or your family have shopped in a Hobby Lobby store. We've invited Mr. Green this morning to talk with you about the important things that he's experienced in his life, about Christian leadership and the importance of having strong character. In the first session, he'll talk about his company and the biblical principles that Hobby Lobby employs to lead as a Christian company in the retail world. He'll tell you about the major legal battle they faced a few years ago as they stood up for what the Bible says about the importance of human life. Hobby Lobby employs more than 32,000 people. Boy, that's a lot of people to take care of. In the second session, he'll discuss character traits Hobby Lobby looks for in its employees and why these traits are so important. He'll give you suggestions for applying biblical principles to develop your own character. And by the way, Mr. Green is also the man behind the Museum of the Bible, which opened recently in Washington, D.C., just three blocks from the U.S. Capitol. I can't think of anything more beautiful than that. The museum presents the Bible's history and narrative, and it depicts the profound impact that the scriptures have had on the world. And with its strategic location, we can expect millions of people to visit that museum in the next several years. And so Mr. Green has come to share with you as a group of young people, and I hope that you've come to learn this morning. So please join me in welcoming this morning Mr. Steve Green.
Thank you. Thank you. Blessings. Thank you, Dr. Pettit. It's an honor for me to be here and an honor for me to follow Ken Ham last year. As I understand, I was introduced to both Bob Jones and Ken Ham through homeschool. Me and my wife, we homeschooled our oldest four children. We have six for about 13 years and connected with both those great organizations, Ken Ham and Answers in Genesis, as well as Bob Jones, and have been following for many years. And it's been an honor for me to be here one other time a few years back when we had our Bible Museum had a temporary exhibit in Charlotte, and I came here and spoke at that time. But so it's an honor for me to be here to share a little bit about Hobby Lobby, our journey, a little bit about the Museum of the Bible, and how all that got started. Let me start, though, with Hobby Lobby. And my father was the one that started Hobby Lobby. He started his retail career when he was in high school. He traveled around many different cities, but wound up in Altus, Oklahoma, a small town in Oklahoma, southwest part of Oklahoma. And he and school was not his best subject, as he would say. And so there was a program called DECA, Distributive Education. I don't know if schools have that around here anymore or not, but what you could do is you could go get a job, and that job counted as part of your schooling. You would interview, the teacher would interview your boss at a job and fill out a form, and that got to count as part of your schooling. And so my dad, who didn't have a lot growing up, said, I can get out of school and I can earn some money. You can sign me up. I'll jump at that chance. So took a small job at what was at that time called a five and dime store called McClellan's. Some of you probably don't know what that would be like. It'd be like the drugstore on the corner. It's just a small general merchandise store, without the drugstore, general merchandise. And did very well. He had a boss that did taught him well, and he took to it naturally. My dad was a hard worker, and it was very organized, which are a couple of skills that will help in the retail career. Just wanted to keep things in order and working hard. So he did very well and was advancing, would change companies eventually, went to a company called TGNY. Both of these companies don't exist anymore, but TGNY was based out of Oklahoma City. He eventually moved to Oklahoma City, where I was born, and I've lived there all my life. So at TGNY, he got a store, became a manager of a store, was one of the youngest managers that had ever been given a store, and was doing very well. He became a supervisor, was one of the youngest supervisors of store for TGNY. So he just has a natural gift and ability and hard worker and diligent and was doing well in the retail career. And then it was in 1970. As he was working for TGNY there in Oklahoma City, in 1970, he started manufacturing mini frames. There was a design trend at the time where people would get a whole group of small frames and decorate on the wall with a collage of different small frames. And he saw a need, and there was not enough supply for the demand. So he borrowed $600 and bought a chopper. It was just a machine that would take a molding and chop it at a 90-degree angle and you know, different sizes. And started manufacturing mini frames, he and another partner. So this was in 1970. Now, me and my brother at that time, I was seven, my brother was nine, and he would bring sacks of these pieces of molding home, and me and my brother would glue these together. They would have vices where you'd tighten it. We'd have four or five different vices. We'd tighten, glue the frames, put them in the vise, tighten it, and then rotate it, and by the time we got through the fourth one, we'd get back to the first one, we'd, you know, take it out, and we earned 7 cents a frame for gluing these frames together. That was how we earned our bubblegum money or baseball card money. And so early on, we were involved in the business, in the manufacturing side of the business. So he did that for a couple of years in 1970. Then in 1972, he rented a 600-square-foot space. And in the back 300 square feet is where he put the manufacturing operation that was called Greco. And in the front 300 square foot, he opened a little retail store and called it Hobby Lobby. The 300 square foot may be a modest living room today. And that was all we had at that time. That was in 1972. Me and my brother were still going to school. My mom would go down and work for free, you know, running the shop and keeping things going, as my dad still had a day job. He was still working at TGNY as a manager and supervisor. And so that was in 1972. It wasn't until 3 years later, in 1975, when he quit his day job to spend his full time at this new startup, struggling startup. Now, at that time, he was making probably a upper middle class wage, about $26,000 is what he was making as an employee of TGNY. And he took about a half cut in pay. So it cut to about $13,000 a year when he left in 1975. And so probably a lower middle class income at that point. And I just remember running through the kitchen and my mom and dad sitting at the kitchen table having a discussion and you know, not knowing what it was about, but it was a serious discussion, and they were talking about Dad leaving this full-time position, and it was going to be a challenge for the family financially. And but Dad was convinced it was what he was supposed to do. So left in 1975. In 1974, the year before Dad quit, Hobby Lobby at that time did about $150,000. So again, not a lot, but it was, you know, making some money. In 1975, the year that my dad quit, we did $750,000. So it was a five-time increase in our business. Don't think we've ever repeated that since then. But it was showing that with the attention that Dad was able to give it full-time, he was able to get this new startup on the ground and moving well. We just grew up going to public schools, just like any other typical home, middle class home, and you know, we would regularly go to church and just your typical home. This was a bit of a struggle, a bit of a challenge, and Dad, as he invested time and energy and effort, the business continued to grow and expand, and his dream was always to expand this. You know, as TGNY had stores across the country, and that was kind of the model he saw and he wanted, and so the idea was always to grow it. Now, he'd always had a 4 or 5 year plan. You know, I want to have 5 stores, each doing $1 million at one point, and then once he, you know, hit that, then it just continued to grow. So there's always a plan, a drive to grow the business and to be successful in the arts and crafts business. When we first started, the store hours, we had closed at 5:30, except for Thursday night. We opened till 8, and we're not open on Sunday. That's the way we got started. But then as we started going into some other states where we had some competition, we felt, Dad felt he needed to compete with the competition. So in those other states, we opened on Sundays, and we opened later hours. But in Oklahoma, we didn't because we didn't have the competition. And so we started out not opening on Sundays, but then we wound up, after a while, opening our stores on Sunday. And obviously, you know, today we don't again. But again, it was just a struggle. I remember during that time, we had a store in Tulsa, which was one of our top stores. We had five or six stores at the time, and that store got flooded. It had probably a foot to 2 foot of water in the store. Depending on where you're at in the store, part of it was a little lower than the other, and so there were a significant impact on that store, being one of our larger volume stores with only five or six stores at the time, and so it was a significant impact on the company. And I remember as we were driving to Tulsa, we from Oklahoma City, it's about a two-hour drive. I remember Dad was, you know, just thinking out loud, you know, how are we going to survive? What can we do? And I remember him coming up with this idea, let's send a note to all of our vendors and letting them know that we have a significant financial hit on our company and ask if they would give us a discount on the invoices that are outstanding. And so it was ideas like that that he had, that he was always able to figure out how that we would be able to pay the bills, and sent that note out, and a lot of vendors were willing to help us out. But there were times it was a struggle. I mean, this was a new business, new company that it just takes a lot of hard work and a lot of effort. So as Dad continued to expand and grow the business, we eventually continued to grow and continue to be successful. And to jump to today, as was mentioned, we are in 48, or looking in 48 of the contiguous states. We're not looking at Alaska or Hawaii. So the only state we're not in today is Delaware, because we haven't found a location there yet. We're negotiating on some sites, but we're looking in the 48 contiguous states, and we're in 47 of 48 of those. We had always had a radius around Oklahoma City, which was where we were looking. And then as that radius was having a hard time finding locations, and we would expand the radius until a few years ago, we expanded to include the whole 48 contiguous states. So really don't have any more space to expand without crossing a body of water or a border, and we're not interested in doing that right now. So today we have 800 stores that are open, and when I had our real estate guys look through each of the states, and I said, I want you to find every city that we can put a store, and I want you to know in every larger market, everywhere you would like a store, if you could wave a magic wand and today put a store in everywhere we could. And we came up with about 1,400 locations altogether. So 800 of those we have, and we have room to grow and in those 48 contiguous states, and so that's where we're currently looking. 95% of everything that goes into our stores in the country comes through the warehouse facilities in Oklahoma City. We have about 10 million square feet of warehouse office space, manufacturing space in Oklahoma City where all of the product comes. So every store will receive a truck every week from our facility in Oklahoma City. They're placing an order. We have about 70,000 items, over 70,000 items in our warehouse that they're checking every week, and they order what they need. That order goes into the corporate office, it's pulled, and a truck comes to the store. So every week, 800 stores are getting a truck from Oklahoma City. So we've got a significant trucking operation as well. Most of that is being delivered on our own trucks. We still have the manufacturing operation there in Oklahoma City in that 10 million square feet, where if you order a custom frame in one of our stores, that order goes to Oklahoma City. It's chopped, assembled, and sent to the store on that truck, as well as other our fixtures and other items that we have that we do manufacturing there in Oklahoma City. We also have an office in Hong Kong, in China, with about 200 employees over there, a buying and resourcing office in Hong Kong. We do a lot of the product that we buy is directly imported from the countries where it's made, and that all of that product primarily comes in to LA on a ship, and then from LA it's railed into Dallas, and then from Dallas we bring that up on our trucks to Oklahoma City. So if you were to drive from Dallas to Oklahoma City, you would probably pass dozens of our containers because we're averaging over 2,000 containers a month that we have coming in from importing from overseas. And so we continue to expand and grow. There's a lot of opportunities. This last year, we opened 51 stores in multiple states across the country. This year, I think we'll probably hit 55 to 60 stores is what we will look at opening. We're just trying to get to that 1,400 stores as quickly as we can because we're profitable, and we want to get up to that size as quickly as we can. And so over the years, there's been a lot of lessons learned, a lot of opportunities to grow and expand. And I just want to share two of the significant family meetings that we've had in the history of our business. The first one was because of the year of 1985. In the spring of 1986, my father invited the family over to the house. And at the time, I had two cousins that were involved, my brother, my sister, my parents, my brother-in-law were all involved in the business. And my cousin, my brother had small children. My dad wanted them to get babysitters so that he could just address the family. Now, we have family meetings regularly, but this was a significant family meeting where in the spring of 86, he sat us down and he basically said he did not know how that we would survive. He had always been able to figure out, as I said, how that we would be able to pay the bills. It was, you know, tight, and there would be this income that would come in that this bill would be able to pay. This tax bill was going to be due, and we would be able to pay it based on this revenue. And so there had always been a way that he, on paper, could figure out how that we would be able to survive. But in 1986, he did not know how that we could do that. The reason being was because 1985 was the only year in our history that we lost money. And for our business, we lost a significant amount. What had happened was the oil boom in the oil patch of the country in Oklahoma, where most of our stores were, Oklahoma and Texas, the oil boom had busted and the economy was struggling. There were businesses going out of business left and right. And so we were no different. We were struggling. 85 was our loss, and it was in the spring of 86 when Dad didn't see how we could make it. Most of our profits at the time was made in the fourth quarter. So we had 9 months of struggles before the revenue would start increasing where most of our profits were made. So Dad wanted to let the family know that he didn't know how that we would be able to survive. He has written about it in his book, More Than a Hobby, and sharing this, that he spent a lot of that year crying out to God, spent it away from the phone because the phone calls weren't pleasant. He'd walk the park and pray and just really cry out to God and say, God, I don't know how to survive. And if you want this company to survive, you're going to have to intervene because I don't see us making it. And that's what he was sharing with the family at that time. And, you know, we were all dependent upon this business. And so we were having to think. My wife, we were expecting our first child. What are we going to do? But Dad would say in that year, it was, first part, it was just one bad news after another. You know, the bank was calling a note or a partner was quitting, or then the partner was suing for some reason, and it just was a very tough part time in our history. But there was a point in that year where things turned around and the news started getting good news. It was good news that was coming in. And that year wound up being about double our best profit year ever when we wound up at the end of that year. Obviously, we did survive. And there was one particular lesson that Dad took away from that year that he still applies and still wants us to learn today, and that is that this is not our business. This is God's business. We are stewards of what God has entrusted to us. And it is our responsibility to operate our business in according to the principles that he has given us in his word. So that lesson, Dad still to this day will teach us and talks about. Even more recently, he has written a book called Giving It All Away and Getting It All Back Again, where he talks about this concept that really was foundational to our estate planning. Point one is this is God's company. And when you start there, then you do things differently than what the world might do it. So when we understand we are just stewards of what God has entrusted with us, we operate our business differently. And that kind of leads us into a second family meeting that we had, and this was in 2012. At that time, we were facing a new challenge. As you know, there was a law passed in our country that mandated employers provide insurance, and that the insurance that they provided for their employees, if they provided insurance, had to include four products that could be abortive, abortifacients. Now, that's not what they're referred to. They're referred to as contraceptives, but these contraceptives could be abortive. So the concern that we had was that we were going to be required to freely provide products that could take life. Now, Beckett had approached our company in 2011 because they knew this was coming. They knew that the law required that, and that as a company's insurance renewed, they had to abide by the new mandate that was requiring these products. So they had approached us and said they would like to defend and be there for the court challenge that would take place. And at first we said, you know, we don't think it's ready yet because there were a couple of decisions that could cause the problem to go away. There was a new presidential election that was going to happen, and had the election gone differently, that problem might have gone away. There was a Supreme Court challenge to the mandate, and had that ruling gone differently, that problem could have gone away. And so we said, well, we don't need to yet. Let's just see if, in fact, this becomes a problem for us that we are going to have to be required to provide these products. So when those events happened and we still were facing this mandate, Beckett came back to us and talked to our legal counsel. Legal counsel talked to the family and said, you know, at the end of this year, at the end of 2012, when our plan renews, we will be required or we will be fined. We'll be required in our health plan to provide these products. And so that's what created another family meeting. My dad invited the family over. At this time, there was probably 18 or so of us at this meeting because we had my parents, me, my brother, my sister, and then our kids. We had 10 kids. Some of them were married. So there's about 18 of us that made it to this particular family meeting. And my dad wanted to hear from everybody. So it kind of started with Gen 3, as we refer to them. My parents, Gen 1, me, my brother, sister, Gen 2, and our kids, Gen 3. So we heard from everybody, and there were some honest discussions about the ramifications of this particular decision that we were making. The fine, if it were to be applied to everybody in the health plan, and it was not clear, but if it was to apply to everybody, the fine would have been $1.2 million a day. And that was not sustainable. And those discussions were mentioned. Here's a decision that we're facing that if we are assessed that fine, the risk for the company was significant. And so that's why Dad wanted to have this meeting. Now, Beckett had approached us for a couple of reasons. One, because they knew that we would be a good case for them to argue. And part of that was because of the way we operated our business. If you go to our statement of purpose online, and you can see it there, the very first statement we make on our statement of purpose is that we operate our business according to biblical principles. And again, that kind of goes back to our first family meeting of 1985. And we put that in writing. We says that is our first purpose, is to operate according to the principles that God has given us in His Word. And so they saw that, and they knew that was good. It was an argument. We're not just saying this, but we mean it. And it's not that we just say it. We live it out. And a couple examples that they would look at was, one was our newspaper ads. We have ran a full-page ad in the newspapers for many years at Easter and Christmas that you may be familiar with. That started many years ago when my father was going through the Christmas paper and was seeing that nobody at the time was saying Merry Christmas. They were saying Season's Greetings or Happy Holidays. It was like they were even avoiding at that time many years ago the word Christmas. And so he was frustrated, you know, because there was nobody recognizing the holiday for what it was all about. And he just felt like God said, well, neither are you. Not that we wouldn't say Merry Christmas, but we just ran our normal ad and we're marketing our business. And so Dad just felt convicted. So the next Christmas, and that was in 1996, we ran a quarter of a page ad that just shared, here's what this holiday is all about. No, you know, we might have had our ad, but this particular ad was just about, here's what this holiday is all about. And it was small. You may argue or may could say that it was because our faith was small at that time. You know, let's just do a little quarter of a page. The next Easter, it went well, so we went to a half a page ad for the next Easter. And then the following Christmas, we did a full page ad and has been a full page ad ever since. And we do it, we run the ad in every market and for every location that we have. And so Beckett saw that we were public in our position and our faith through the newspaper ads that we had been running. Now, I always got the letters that we had responded, and early on in the 90s, it was letters that were written. Today, there's more comments that we get on social media, but at the time, it was letters that people would write in, and it was overwhelmingly positive. It was over 95% positive, with a handful of negative letters. One time, there was 1,000 letters and 5 or 6 negative. And so I remember collecting the letters, the interesting positive ones and all of the negative ones, because there wasn't very many, thinking someday this would be a good book. And so a few years later, I wrote the book, Faith in America, and it starts with the letters that we would receive, starts with the negative letters and ends with the positive letters that tells about that journey. So Beckett saw that we were being public with our faith. And then the other thing that they saw was that we were closed on Sundays. And as I mentioned, we had opened, and it was a couple years after we started doing our newspaper ads that, again, Dad was felt convicted about opening on Sundays, that, you know, if we're being public with our faith, we were getting some comments about, well, why are you open on Sundays? And so not because we felt like it was a legalistic issue that we had to close, but we said, well, if we want to honor God, then we want to close our stores on Sundays, as well as for our employees so that they can spend time with their families. My dad, you know, when he was with TGNY, he was required to work on every other Sunday. And he could go to church and leave early and work at the store, but he missed out on family time. And so so we kind of had a 2-year plan. We were going to close our stores a little bit at a time. We were going to start in a state and then move to over a 2-year period to go throughout the states and close all of our stores. And again, you could argue that we started with our faith was small, and we were going to just kind of give it a try. As a matter of fact, my father made a comment to our head of our advertising. He said, you know, what we'll do is we're going to close a state, and then we're going to see how it goes. And if it goes okay, then we're going to expand. And we had this kind of 2-year plan. And so our head of advertising was interviewed by a paper in one of the states, and he is just repeating what Dad said. And so Dad is getting the newspaper article, reading it. He's reading his own words. It says, if it goes okay, then we're going to go ahead and close the other states. And again, he felt like God spoke to him. He says, oh, so if it works okay for you, you're going to obey. But if it's not, you're not. So Dad calls up the advertising director and says, don't say that again. We're going to close our stores. And we did it over a 2-year period, state by state, and eventually closed our stores. Now, during that two-year period, the profits of our company were soft. We still were profitable, but they were soft. But after that 2-year period, the year that all the stores were closed, we had a record profit year again. And so, again, I think there might have been a bit of God testing us, saying, okay, are you serious about doing this or not? Now, when we first started that, Dad calculated how much business we would be doing on Sunday. It would, per hour, be the busiest day, because you're only open during the busy time of the day. And the amount of business that we would have done on Sunday was $100 million that we were going to walk away from. And so that's where, again, you could argue that our faith grew in this process. And then I think God rewarded us at the end with record profits. So Beckett knew both of those. They knew that we made the statement that we were going to operate our business according to biblical principles. They saw the newspaper ads. They saw that we were closed on Sundays. They knew that we were a good client to argue for this case that mandated we provide abortifacients to our employees for free that violated our conscience. And so we, in this family meeting, everybody shared the discussion of the ramifications, serious discussions. And one of the thoughts was that if we do this, that God really had three options for us. Daniel gives us two of those options. One was, if you recall, Daniel, when he was taken captive, was told to eat the king's meat, and that violated Jewish law. Daniel had determined in his heart, I am not going to eat the king's meat, but he didn't have a rebellious heart. He wanted to have a obedient spirit. He appealed to the jailer and said, how about if you let us just eat bread and water? And they eventually let them have just not have to violate their conscience, and the problem was averted. That's the first option that God had. You know, problem could be averted. Secondly, Daniel later in life was told that he couldn't pray to his God, and that violated his faith as well. Now, it's interesting. It says that Scripture says when he knew. So in this case, when he knew, and there was not an option of an appeal at this time, because the law couldn't be changed, there was no appeal option for him. And so it's almost he intentionally opens the window and prays to his God. It's almost an intentional, I'm going to follow my God, and he let it be known. And so in this case, he faced the lion's den. And what happened? God had to show up, and in this case, God delivered. First time it was averted, second time God delivered. But sometimes God has a third option. Sometimes he pulls a third option out of the toolbox. Sometimes he allows suffering. Job did lose it all. Job was a godly man, and yet he lost it all. God allowed that. Stephen was stoned. All the disciples but one martyred. You're sitting there thinking, God, what are you thinking? You know, I thought we're supposed to have health, wealth, and prosperity. Don't you want the best for us? Sometimes God does allow suffering. Ultimately, Christ died on the cross. But it is always for his good. What Satan means for evil, God means for good. My brother made a movie called Into the Spear. I don't know if you've seen it. It's about five missionaries that were killed in 1956 in Ecuador. These were five promising young men. Top of their class, Jim Elliot's the most well-known. And some felt like they were kind of throwing their life away because they go down to this remote part of the Amazon jungles and ministering to some people down there. And there is a tribe that has never had a peaceful contact with humankind, with people outside of their tribe. They are pretty vicious. Secular anthropologists later went down and studied them and determined that they were the most violent society ever documented by secular anthropologists. The chance that you would be killed by your own tribe was astronomical. It was over 50%. I don't remember what the exact numbers were. So here is a violent tribe that these five missionaries, while they were working the mission field, they had a heart to try to reach this tribe. And they eventually had a peaceful contact, the first peaceful contact with this tribe that had ever happened. And they were excited. And you're sitting here and you're thinking, okay, God, we see what you're doing. We understand why these five guys are giving what appear to be giving their life away, but you have them to reach this tribe. So they again go in and try they fly in on a plane onto a sandbar and they get dropped off one at a time until all five of them are in there. There was one pilot, Nate Saint, that flew him in there. And they're on this sandbar just waiting for the tribe to come back out. They've had a peaceful contact, and they've given them, they've tried to, through dropping things through an airplane, they've tried to reach his people, befriend them, speak their language. They had somebody that had come out of the tribe that taught them some of the language and tried to talk to them. So they've done all of this to try to reach this people. And then they had that one peaceful, then here's the second time. They come out, there's a couple of them that come out of the woods and talking to them. And then the rest of the tribe comes out and spears all five of them to death. And you think, God, what are you thinking? These guys, they were there doing your bidding. They were there reaching this unreached people, and yet you allowed them to die. What are you thinking? And again, what Satan means for evil, God uses for good. One of the sisters, the pilot's sister, Rachel Saint, wound up going and living with that group of people for 30, 40 years as a translator. She was bringing to them God's word. The reason the secular anthropologist went and studied this people is because their violence reduced by over 90%. And as in the documentary that my brother did, he talks to these two secular anthropologists. And the way they said it is new information was brought and their violence stopped just like that. Now, that's their term. They didn't say what that new information was. It was Rachel Saint bringing scripture to them, telling them of a different way, that there was a loving God that did not want them to be killing each other, and that he sent his son that they might have life. And I also understood that that created one of the greatest mission efforts the world had ever seen. More mission efforts, more people went onto the mission field because of that story. So what Satan meant for evil, God uses for good. So one of the options is suffering. Sometimes God allows suffering. One of the comments that I make to my kids often is God is not as concerned with what you go through as how you respond to what you go through. God is big enough to help us and lead us and give us grace to deal with anything. But the question is, how are you going to respond to what you go through? Job, let's see, how do you respond when you lose it all? How are we going to respond to the challenges that we face in life? You will face challenges. You will face struggles. You will face sorrow. You will face heartache. I think the question God's looking at is saying, how are you going to respond to it? Are you going to get bitter? Are you going to shake your fist at me and say, how dare you, God? Or are you going to trust that I've got you covered? I'm there with you. I love you. I desire the best for you. Because that is our God. So we knew that there were these three options. It could be averted, delivered, or suffered. But we did not know what was going to happen. And we are thankful and grateful that we did have the win at the Supreme Court. It was a close decision. There was... We went there for the oral arguments, and we were all gathered in the room. Me, my wife, and a couple of our kids were actually at Oxford. We had an event there. The rest were, we were Skyping in. The rest were in our conference room with our attorney. And you're watching a script. They're typing, here's what's being said, and you're watching that. Again, had a win. A great celebration, and we're thankful that, in essence, the problem was averted. But that doesn't mean that we still don't have challenges and issues that we face. There's still times where God allows suffering. God allows us to face things. And I think that the question that I think God was saying is that it's easy to talk is cheap. We can say we operate according to biblical principles, but are we really? Sometimes God just tests us to check to see if we mean what we say. And we think that that was a challenge for the family. So at that meeting, it was unanimous. We had to challenge, and we did, and we won. So that is where we see God's hand in our business. And And then I'll just end with telling you a little bit about my story. I grew up, as I said, going to public schools, and I remember I was a senior in high school when I was sitting in an auditorium similar to this, and I was just kind of sitting by myself. I don't remember if it was before and after an assembly, but I'm just sitting in the seat, and I'm thinking about, okay, my college, what am I going to do about college? And I remember thinking, I think I know what I want to do. I'm just going to go ahead and go work in the business. I had, as I said, started with Seven Gluing Frames, and then through high school, we would work at the store during the summer. On weekends, Thursday nights, we would go down and work at times. And so I'd mow lawn, I'd unload trucks, we'd clean bathrooms, we'd, you know, set fixtures, work a frame table. That's what me and my brother did as we were growing up. So I knew what I wanted to do, and so I graduated and just told Dad I was ready to go to work. And so Dad gave me a job and started working. I was a liaison. I would go between the stores and the corporate. I'd, you know, tell them, here's what's going on, what are issues you're dealing with, let me see if we can resolve those. My title was a liaison. We had, I think, 6 stores at the time. And started working and did a variety of different jobs. I was given some buying duties, started some buying, worked in a variety of different areas, trying to get a sense of the whole business. And then I remember is when I was in my late 20s that I was hiring managers. I said, our manager is such a key position in our business because a manager can make a huge difference in a store if they operate it well and versus if they don't do it well. And so I wanted to hire the manager. So I was interviewing, I don't know, 100 managers. I would hire 40 a year for a few years. And I remember sitting there interviewing guys that had been in retail longer than I had been alive. And I'm just sitting there scratching my head. Why am I here? Why am I the one interviewing this guy that he ought to be the one interviewing me? But I was where I was, and I had to realize that I was where I was simply because of who my father was. It wasn't necessarily that I deserved it or earned it. I graduated high school, and I was given a job. And that was challenging. And yet that's where I was. And so I'm sitting here hiring these guys and giving them jobs and putting them to work and having to struggle with that. And I got to realize that, okay, well, God, you put me here. And I'll be here as long as you want me to. And if there's somebody that's better that you want to replace me with, then I will trust that. And then it was kind of a light bulb went on when I realized, you know what, that's really no different than my salvation. I have received a gift from my Heavenly Father that I didn't deserve, didn't earn, simply because of who my Father is. I don't deserve it. I'm a wretch. And yet His Son came and paid the price that I might have life. And He freely gave it to me. And so it was as if God was saying, you know what? I've got a plan and a purpose for you, for your life. And in just the same way as your salvation, it's not because you earned it or deserved it. It's simply because of who your Father is. And for that, I am grateful and I am thankful that I am where I am. Because I have a loving God that desires the best for me. Not everybody's going to have that opportunity. I don't know what God's plan is for your life. It may not be that you're going to have a position like mine. But you do have the opportunity to have an abundant, eternal life simply because of who your Father is. So, thank you for your time.